think that actually it's kind of hard to hear, because I think a couple of folks might not be on mute. If you could mute your phone. Okay. So yeah. So when it comes to the sampling, I think that's the best way to do it would be to kind of look at your community, look at the demographics of your community, and match the response to that. Is that what the question was getting at, Lori?
Yes. And if I could just remind you, if you don't have a mute button on your phone, such as if you're on a cell phone, you can dial *6, and that will mute your phone. And then when you want to speak, you can dial *6 again to unmute your phone, because we do hear some background noise, and this session is being recorded. Yes, that definitely gets to the question that was asked, Chris, especially in relation to how you use the census as a basis for quota sampling. I think the second part to that question is the question that you said is very difficult to answer, is how do I know what percentage of my population to survey to get valid data? So
right.
Is it, you know, if your overall population is 100,000 and it's a community-wide survey, what percent do you need to get overall, regardless of all the subpopulations, to have some valid data to draw some conclusions?
Right, and that's one of those questions that there are, if you want to use confidence intervals and kind of go the statistical route with a probability sample, that is possible, but that might be something that we'll have to have a more in-depth conversation about. But there is no real answer. If I have 100,000 people in my community, how big does my sample have to be? I would say that you might want to look at maybe a percentage or a fraction of your population. But again, the idea with sampling isn't necessarily that you're looking to get a certain percentage of your population, especially when it comes to probability sampling, but that you are getting statistically enough to make it valid and reliable. Again, those statistical measures are something that we might want to talk about in depth kind of outside, because that's kind of beyond the survey basics. So if you know those, or if you're familiar with those, I would say you could use those. But if not, and if you want to keep this a good, valid, reliable survey that has good basis in empirical findings, I would stick with the quota sampling method.
Okay, thank you. Does anyone have any follow-up questions to that question or that discussion? Okay, let me go ahead and Chris, ask you another question that came in through email. Do you have an opinion about employing multiple survey methods in order to reach as many people in your target population as possible with as little cost as possible? This particular person is working with a team on developing a survey, and they are considering beginning with a mail survey followed up by some combination of phone calls and in-person visits to those who don't respond to the mail survey.
Using a mixed method is something that's been done quite a bit. You know, kind of old school researchers used to say that it should never be done, but those of us who kind of work in communities and do more applied research know that sometimes you have to follow up with a phone call or go by somebody's office to get them to respond, especially if you feel that their response is important to the survey. So I think that my opinion is that it's, you know, definitely useful. I would say you have to be careful about how when you're kind of giving the survey in an oral fashion, you want to be careful not to influence or bias the respondent in any way by quickly going through a question, by suggesting that they answer it a certain way. Sometimes tone and inflection is important there when it comes to that. I also would probably think if you were going to do a mixed method survey before you actually write the survey, think through your questions, because remember, a written survey is very different than an oral survey when it comes to the answers that people are given to respond to. you give 20 multiple choice answers, it's going to be really difficult to administer that, you know, via oral or a phone survey. So just keep that in mind if you're thinking about doing a mixed method. But they're, you know, it's a good way to get a lot of information and to make sure that important people respond to your survey. So I have no problem at all with mixed methods.
Great,
and
thank you.
I've used them quite a bit. So.
Thank you. Does anyone have a follow-up question based on that response?
Hi. I'm calling from Chicago. I have a question in regards to that mixed method. So if you're doing it mixed method and there's going to be some lag time in between, how much is a good amount? Is it the 2 weeks, like you were saying, for getting responses? Or would you consider doing oral and written and all these things all at the same time?
Well, I would probably suggest that you prepare yourself to do the mixed method before you actually administer the written survey.
Okay.
And then wait a couple weeks, wait 2 weeks. If nobody responds, I would send out the written survey again, wait another 2 weeks, and then if nobody responds, you'd go and try and call them up or go by their office to do the, you know, the oral survey.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Other questions related to that topic?
I'm also calling from the Chicago area, and I'm going to take you back to the previous one that we talked about. Are we likely to be having another session that talks about the sample size and statistical significance of the sample?
We currently don't have that. Are you on speakerphone?
Yes, I am on speakerphone.
Is there any chance you could turn your volume down just a little bit? I think I'm getting some feedback on it. That's a great question, and we are constantly identifying training needs, and it sounds like there are a lot of questions in that area, so I will definitely document that as a need as we talk with the Department of Public Health about trainings that we can offer next year. So if there's strong interest in that, please make sure you note that on your feedback evaluation survey.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Because that would be a training in and of itself, but it could be done, so.
Definitely. Are there other questions right now before I go to another email question? Okay. Chris, one question that we had was when you're testing a survey, how many people do you really need to test the survey with to feel like you've done a good job in testing it?
Well, that's one of those "it depends" kind of answers that I have to give. I think that I always feel comfortable giving it to at least three different people just to get their feedback on it. That's my own rule, just because I found from experience, if you ask one person, you're just getting one opinion. Two, if the two opinions conflict, then you don't know how to solve the problem, but three is kind of that odd number. So you can help kind of gauge. But if you have the opportunity, I would suggest you give it out to, you know, 5 to 10 people just to kind of see how they, you know, how they're going to respond to that survey.
And if you are making sure that you have certain subpopulations surveyed, is it important to test the survey with each of those groups? Are individuals representing those groups or not?
Yeah, I would say you really would like to get individuals who are representing those groups. That's you know a part of me doesn't want to say that because it assumes that one individual or two individuals are kind of completely representing that group. So it's difficult. I think that the individuals that you want to use should have the kind of the knowledge that they're testing this for a community, so that they need to think through how the community would be responding to this, or you know the subpopulation that they represent would be responding to this, and they should have some, you know, you'd hope that they'd have some knowledge of that.
And you're really, one of your testing functions is to see if you're getting the type of data that you were trying to get, so that you've asked
right.
the questions in a way that's not confusing and right. that solicits the level of response that you were looking for. Is that correct?
Right, right, that it makes sense
okay.
to folks, and that the wording that is correct, the even sometimes the order of the questions is important, so if that's correct.
Okay.
Clearly, from testing, if folks have a hard time answering the survey, you know you've got to do something to make it, to change it and make it easier. Because, again, these are not LSATs. These are not GRE tests, you know. This is not, they should be relatively easy for everybody to answer, so.
That brings me to the follow-up question. If you have developed a survey and you've tested it and you find that you're either not getting the information you need or there are some confusing questions, but let's say maybe you didn't necessarily test it, but you're finding this information out after you had already started administering it, what is the general rule of thumb about, you know, changing a survey after you've started? I know, for example, in SurveyMonkey, if you go back and change a question because you find out that it's not working, you have to scrub your data. You lose all of your data mm-hmm. that's already been collected.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and I think, I mean, unfortunately, that's the issue that we all face when we write a question and don't test it as good as we'd like to, or we, try to quickly do a survey and then decide that we want to change it in the middle. We lose that data, because the key principle to a survey is that you're asking the same questions to everybody. It's a standardized instrument, so that the responses are as standardized as possible, so that you can aggregate them to find out how people, as a group, respond to certain questions. So yeah, I mean. I would, you know, you should never change the question, the wording of the question, or what the question is trying to get at.
Great, thank you. Does anyone have any follow-up questions to that? No? Okay. Another question is, you spent a little bit of time talking about cultural appropriateness, and you said something about questions being neutral. Can you clarify that?
Yeah. The question should not include any kind of gender-specific, race-specific, ethnic-specific information in them, because it leaves the opportunity to kind of bias the response or the respondent in responding a certain way. And in a sense, it also includes information that might not necessarily be true for everybody. So you want to keep them neutral. Use pronouns like you. Use pronouns like people. Don't use, specific words. I think that helps. That especially helps if you're giving a survey across different groups of people or across different cultures, because then folks don't feel like, oh, well, this question isn't for me because it doesn't refer to, how I identify myself or whatnot. So yeah, I think that's important to do. And if you look at questions like really good questions that have been tested and are tried and true, like those from the survey, from the census, or from BRFSS, you won't see any kind of race or gender specific question in there, really.
Right.
Of course, and I should add, of course, there's slight exceptions. Like if you are giving a survey to a group of women, clearly you're going to be asking certain questions that are appropriate for women that wouldn't be appropriate for men. But still, you want to keep them as neutral as possible.
Okay. Does anyone else have any other questions related to cultural appropriateness? Okay. We have just about five to ten more minutes, and I'd like to open it up now to any questions. It doesn't have to be on the topics we've already discussed. Any questions at all that any of you have, please feel free to go ahead and ask now.
Hi, I have a question, I'm sorry, and I kind of slept through it. It was on the last topic we were talking about, if you make changes to a survey.
Mm-hmm.
So if you make changes to a survey and you change it based on, and you've now created it as another version, mm-hmm. are you still required to kind of lose that data that was collected prior to?
Well,
how does that work?
Yeah, I mean, if you're making a second version of a survey, that has to stand as its own survey.
Okay.
You can't necessarily aggregate the data from the second version with the data from the first version.
Mm-hmm.
You could compare the two
okay.
to see the difference. But, again, the idea is that these survey instruments are standardized tools, and therefore the responses are standardized. And so one little change can, you know, alter the validity and the reliability of the survey and your responses. So.
Okay. And I have one other question while
sure.
I'm on. Under content,
mm-hmm.
there is the question, it says succinct but robust.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not clear about that.
Yeah, well, you want to, your questions, yeah, and I don't have my slides in front of me, but that's not a big deal. You don't want to add a lot of verbiage into your question if it's not needed. You don't want it to be wordy. You don't want it to ask too much. But you also want it to give the respondent. You want to give the respondent enough information
mm-hmm.
so that they understand fully what you're asking.
Okay.
And that's what I was trying to get at there.
Okay.
It's kind of a hard balancing act.
Okay, so that's a balancing act. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Sure.
And I think that. One thing that I've learned from really diving in and doing a lot of surveys recently is that the testing is where you really find out if you've oversimplified it and then you really aren't asking a meaningful enough question, which I would speak to the robust side, or you also find out that you haven't simplified it enough and it's a confusing question to folks.
Right. Right. That's very true. You know, there was a kind of a rule of thumb that I used to use that no question should be over about 25 words. Sometimes I go over that, so I admit that, but it was just kind of a rule of thumb so that I could keep my question short enough. And then sometimes, of course, I want to pack as much information in there as possible, so I try to use big words. Well, when you test it, you find out that sometimes the bigger words you use, you know, the $5 words, they're not any more helpful. So it is a balancing act.
Thank you so much for that information.
Sure.
I know you said that you could do a whole nother session on validity, but if you had also said something about a 20% return rate on a written survey is good.
Yeah.
Good, valid. I mean, if I send out 100 surveys and I get 20%, can I take that information and share it with the public and make those kinds of, you know, summary you guys said, where do I know that magic number?
That's just from research. They say a good response rate is about 20%. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that, I mean, it can speak to validity, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it is valid. It just means that when, you know, researchers who spend their time researching how people do research say that, I mean, believe it or not, there's a career in that, that they say that about 20% is a good response rate on a written survey. So that is really just to help you gauge, you know, how you're doing when it comes to response rates.
And I think it's because we send out these surveys and we are so discouraged when we only get 20 back. So that guideline helps me say this is pretty much, you know, this is success in terms of response rates. It doesn't mean it's necessarily a high enough number, but it's success in response rates.
Right, right. That's very.
And is there any quick way to assess what that number is? You know, like we're doing a survey and then we're going to see how we should move forward. If we send out 100 surveys, how many do we need back in order for us to say we're confident that this is what the public wants or what the people want?
Yeah, that's the hard question. And because you could say, well, we got 20% back, so that's a good response rate.
Right.
But, you know, but it could be 20, those 20 could have been from, you know, the same organization or something, right? You don't necessarily know that. That's a really, really hard question to answer, and that gets into when it comes to, like, measuring for confidence intervals and whatnot, which is, again, that could be a whole other training, and that's it comes to statistical procedures that you have to kind of create. Depends on what the total number of your universe or that is out that's there, the total number of surveys you send out, your response rate, what you want your confidence interval to be. It's a whole other discussion. I hate to say that because I want to give you an answer, but
mm-hmm.
but I would say that if you sent out a survey with to 100 people and got 20 back and had a 20% response rate, you could say that we have a 20% response rate. That's pretty good. And research shows that 20% response rate is a good response rate, so that we feel comfortable with this. Again,
okay.
You know what I mean? And then there's also other ways. You might want to think about looking at the demographics of the people that responded. Are they reflective of your community? You know, is there a big hole, like a certain population didn't respond or a certain part of your community didn't respond? Things like that that could help you do that. Because you're really trying to justify, without a lot of those statistical procedures, you're trying to justify that this is representative of your community.
And so isn't that why you would want to do some quota sampling?
Right. You could use the quota sampling as one way to do it, for sure. Yeah.
Thank you.
I think that's one of the biggest questions that folks have, especially
right.
those who are working on iPlan and they're trying to gain some community input and participation through their assessment process. And you know, they may serve a community the size of 100,000 or, just the sizes vary greatly, and obviously everything is cost prohibitive. So making some decisions around, how we utilize our resources to the best of our ability, and what number do we pick? And I think a lot of people feel like they're just picking a number out of the sky. I send out 500 surveys, or I send out 100 surveys, and I think that based on some of the things that you've said, and Mark Edgar has also shared, that you really do base your input on the resources that you have available through your team, your whole community planning team, and
right.
You're trying to match your respondents as close to the quota sampling and your census as you can.
Mm-hmm. Right, and you all, when you're doing your iPlans, you know your community. So look at your responses, look at the demographics, look at who responded to that survey, and see if there's a hole. If there's a hole, if you feel like there's a certain group that needs to respond, then you know that. And that could either be a limitation to your survey that you know and you keep in mind when you write it up and then you start making decisions, or you could actually try and actively, go out to that community and have them respond to the survey to try and get their, their responses. So, it's a difficult question. I would love to say that there's a magic number or a magic percent, but there isn't really. So I would say, your community and see who responds, and that should help guide you as to who you need to get or where your hole is in your responses.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Okay, there's one more question here, and it's related to the type of questions. And I know in SurveyMonkey, we showed some samples of those different types of questions. But when you're talking about a Likert question and a ranking question, can you clarify the difference in those two?
Yeah, ranking questions don't necessarily Likert questions are looking at the difference in kind of opinion based on a scale of most to least. So those are the questions, Likert types questions, and Likert was a researcher at some point, I think in the 50s actually, so not too long ago, who created that type of question. So, how do you feel about the presidential candidates? Do you strongly agree, somewhat agree, neither agree nor disagree, disagree or strongly disagree? So it's a scaling like that. It is a ranking because you're kind of ranking your response, where ranking questions can look all sorts of different ways. They can say, here's five different items and rank them 1 to 5. or they can say, you know, choose the top three of 10 items. Likert's type question is a very specific type of question, whereas ranking questions are more kind of general, asking you to rank, and it could be asked in various ways.
And another follow-up question on the ranking is: there, when you're having people rank these items, what's a number that you should reduce? You know, you should limit it to how many items in that ranking category, or you know, rank your top five, or rank your top seven, or rank your top 10, or top 20. Is there some kind of guideline around that?
Yeah, I've read some research on that, and they were saying something like between 4 and 7 is a good number when it comes to ranking, which makes perfect sense to me, because if you're looking at 15, if you have to rank 15 different items, it becomes more difficult. I have seen different ranking questions where they break it up. So you have various, like you have one question that'll give you 5 or 6 items and you can rank those. And then the second question gives you another 5 or 6 items that you can rank. The items are slightly different, but they looked to me to be very similar. You know, and this kind of, they were trying to get at an understanding of a ranking of multiple items, you know, all 12 of those items, for example. So that might be one way that you can do that. But, yeah, most of the research that I've looked at has said between 4 and 7. But there wasn't a hard and fast rule about that one either. I guess 4 to 7 is as hard and fast as we can get right now.
Thank you. Thank you. Other questions? Okay, if there are no other questions, we can conclude the question and answer session. I do want to let all of you know that if you do have any other questions that come up, please feel free to email them to me, Laurie Call, and my email address is in your slides. And I'll make sure we get your question answered by Chris or another expert. And I really would encourage all of you to please complete our online evaluation survey so we can get some feedback and continue to improve for you. And if you have training needs like some of those that were mentioned on the call today, please list those in that feedback so that we can use that data to hopefully be able to meet your needs in the future. So I'd like to thank you, Chris, for joining us today and for the great presentation. And I'd like to thank all of the listeners and hope to be working with you all again soon.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lori. Thanks, everybody. Have a good afternoon.